A Norwegian fisherman finds his voice and tells the story of survival on an American journey. From SDPB, today is Monday, April 14th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Ole Rovak believed in an America where language and history and literature were braided for a stronger democracy. His book, Giants in the Earth, became essential to the canon of immigrant stories. Today, we will spend the hour exploring the place of giants in American literature today. Hundreds of thousands of Norwegians left their homeland to build new lives on a new continent. Rovag wanted that story of suffering and sacrifice and significance to endure. We'll discuss his writing process and what awaits modern readers in the pages of a book written more than a century ago. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. More than a century ago, Ole Rovak, an immigrant from Norway, published a book. It was written in Norwegian and translated into English. The novel was called Giants in the Earth, the title eased from the book of Genesis. There were giants in the earth in those days, and after that, the biblical text reads. Giants in the Earth would become a major work of American literature. It's the story of a family, Per Hansa, a father, and Berit, a mother. As the book opens, the couple are with their children. All their belongings are packed on a wagon. They have become separated from their fellow Norwegian travelers, and they are adrift in a sea of prairie grasslands and uncertainty. Per Hansa, Berit, and their fellow immigrants will strive mightily to make their homes on the South Dakota prairie. They will take the land. They will try to break the land. The land will have its way with their fortunes and with their futures. It's a love story, tragedy, historical record, cultural history, an ecological poem, equal parts adoration and cautionary tale. Perhaps most notably, it is a story of place. This place, and a group of people who sought adventure, security, and community in what today is known as southeastern South Dakota. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra performs Giants in the Earth, the opera, later this month. We'll learn more about that tomorrow on In the Moment. Today, we look at the story, how it was written, why it was written. Later in the hour, we'll even visit the cabin in which it was written, now housed on the campus of Augustana University in Sioux Falls. Let's begin with a new edition of the book, published by the South Dakota Historical Society Press and featuring an introduction and annotations by scholar Alan C. Carlson. Carlson sat down with us in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studios.
It was seen as a major work when it appeared in the 1920s and 1930s, not just as an immigrant book, so to speak, or a hyphenated book, that is, by a hyphenated American, a Norwegian American. It was seen as something great. It kind of fell a little bit out of favor among the professionals in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. The best way to explain that, I think, is there was a coming out of the Depression, coming out of the Americanization frenzy that accompanied World War I, and then the experience of World War II led to a sense of America as a unitary country, and immigration had basically come to a halt in 1930, with both through legal changes and the Great Depression. And hyphenated Americans and hyphenated stories, books by immigrant writers, were seen as a little bit, that's kind of dated. We're looking at a unified America right now. So the book lost a little bit of its luster, although just the quality of it as literature kept it in print. The Harper and Brothers kept it in print until very recently.
What was Rovag's opinion, or what was he calling for as far as how to be that hyphenated person, how to be Norwegian and American? He wasn't a melting pot kind of guy, and he admired, you say, the Jewish people for how they were able to maintain a culture, but he had tenets of this. Tell us a little bit about how he saw America and how he saw immigrants being part of that American story.
The phrase that's used today by historians to describe what his beliefs were is called cultural pluralism, which I think is a great term. And you're right, Rovag directly, in his, some of his nonfiction essays, rejects the idea of the melting pot. You know, melting pot being people come over here, their ethnicities get thrown into a pot, it kind of melts them into some mixture that's much better and larger and greater, but they're Americans, and it's always a changing group. He also rejected Anglo-Saxon preeminence, which was the dominant form of what was called Americanization in the 19-teens, 1920s, and 1930s, which meant everyone had to adjust to the dominant Anglo-American culture, particularly of the East Coast. And he rejected that as well. He favored a land of ethnicities, a democracy of ethnicities. He wanted America to be a multilingual country. He wanted it to be a country open to all. He was quite clear about this, open to all races and creeds and religious groups. He favored, again, a land of many languages. English would be the dominant language for law and other common things, but he favored ethnic neighborhoods. What was he talking about? Well, maybe a way to get a picture of it is we see a little bit of his vision in a city, I'm sure, even like Sioux Falls. You go downtown to go out to eat, and there you've got a Chinese restaurant next to a German restaurant, next to an Afghan restaurant, next to a Laotian restaurant, next to a Mexican restaurant. That's cultural pluralism in the restaurant scene. What Rolvag was looking at was something much broader. He wanted Norwegian children to grow up speaking Norwegian in their homes. He wanted that to be the language of the churches. He was looking for educational systems and again, was in favor of a pluralism of opportunities, but allowing ethnicities to not just survive here, but thrive. And again, as you mentioned, he said the best Americans were in fact the Jews, which was interesting because back then and still to this day, anti-Semites condemn them for being separate, for holding on to things like the Hebrew language as a worship language, and setting themselves apart in many ways. Good Americans, great members of the community, but set themselves apart. Rolvag said, yes, that's the way it should be. And it was true for everybody. And that's what made him a little bit unique. There were others holding to the same view, Jane Addams, the Nobel laureate, founder of Hull House in Chicago, was a cultural pluralist in favor of helping the immigrants maintain their languages, maintain their customs and their cultures in Chicago is where.
Barrett, the character of Barrett, is partially Rolvag expressing the grief of how quickly language comes to America and dies. Her, you know, she has this fear of like, we have done the wrong thing for a number of reasons. Talk a little bit about Per Hansa and Barrett, the love story there, but then how these different characters see the world differently. It can be easy, I think, to slip into a cliche of like the woman wants to go home and the man wants adventure, which I think is so much deeper than that. I don't know how you see their relationship. Tell me a little bit. When you read their relationship, knowing what you know about Rolvag, as a writer and as a scholar, what are some of the things that he's playing out through those characters?
Well, there is, I think, a truth, even to the cliche, as you talk about it. And I've seen, I saw it in my own family, my own grandmothers and my grandfathers, who were immigrants from Sweden. Generally, or broadly speaking, women have attachments that are, I think, in some ways run deeper than men's. To family connections, to communities. They're in some ways very communal. Men generally do want to go off and do something new. Or the Vikings, a perfect example. Things have slowed down on the farm this summer. My buddies and I are gonna get on a boat and go down and raid England for a while. We'll be back in a couple of months. There's something to that. So I think there is that connection. Rolvag captures it, I think, beautifully, poignantly, and in the end, tragically, how that plays itself out. And again, the genius of his storytelling there is understanding this tension in the immigrant experience. And he found a way to tell that tale, I think, probably better than anyone else I've ever seen.
And of course, we have to answer for the raid, whether it's a raid in England or whether it's a raid on land that belongs to someone else and is lived on by someone else. What's Rollvag's relationship with the people who are already here?
It's a very good question. You'll notice in the book, the first section of the book has a subtitle called The Land Taking. And there's at least two big meetings there. On the one hand, the way what Rollvag was trying to say when he meant land taking is that the land was empty, available, and as he put it in one phrase in another essay, the American prairie unleashed the thousand-year-old yearning of the poor for a better life. That's what he saw as the land taking. Now, if I was a Native American and I saw that phrase, land taking, I'd say, well, yeah, that's right, land theft. So that tension is there. What do we say about Rollvag or just about anyone of that time like him? He was when he came to America, he was 22 years old. He had almost no formal education. He was an avid reader, but almost no formal education, like most young Norwegians. And why did he not understand what was really going on there? Well, how would he have even known? Some ways is sort of the question. There was the alternate, we'll call it the narrative of land taking is land theft, wasn't being talked about at that time. There would almost be no place he could even find a book to read about it. That just wasn't there. His view of Native Americans, I think, was quite positive. He certainly saw them as part of this great cultural pluralism mix. In fact, even in the book, when the Native Americans appear, the first time, really, is when he has his first little business venture. He gets into to make a little extra money, he gets into the fur trading business with the Indians. And mutually advantageous to both. That's kind of how he would have seen things. But you're right, he didn't understand that alternate narrative of land, the land taking is land theft. He saw it from the perspective of a young, poorly educated Norwegian peasant who came to America and there was this land that was for free. That's how he saw it.
How are we to read this book today then? What are some of the questions we should bring to the text about our own ancestry, about our own farming practices, about our own literature of the Midwest?
Well, the other theme I talk about in my introduction is this book should be read as what I call an agrarian book. About 100 years ago, throughout the United States, farming, which had blossomed in the 1900 to 1920, farming times were good. The number of farms in the United States reached an all-time high, and prices were actually pretty good, particularly during World War I, when there was a global shortage of food. Farmers were doing quite well. Then it all crashed at the end of the war, and farms were under great financial stress. So a series of books appeared, the agrarian literature of that time, the 20s and 30s, of which Rollvag's book, I think, is a prime example. A defense of small-scale agriculture, a defense of the what we call the family farm. A defense of the farm as a bulwark of democracy, as a bulwark of liberty. The free person, and the Norwegians believed this even before they came to America, the free person is someone who owns land, who has a way to at least be largely self-sufficient if that need came along. So I think, how do we read this book? I think one, recognize Rollvag as a uniquely powerful writer based on cultural pluralism, again, which was not common at the time. He suffered a great deal. He was attacked by the Americanizers. Get rid of the hyphenates, get rid of the hyphen. Rollvag's answer was, the hyphen is our strength. So that's, I think, pretty unusual at the time. And he was actually one of the leaders of the creators of that school of thought. I think we need to give him credit for that. I think we need to give him credit for crafting a novel that defends and celebrates the creation of a new farm. Tremendous amount of labor that goes into that. The value of a place like that to raise a family, the value of that to create a community. I think we need to read the book as a way of capturing at a very personal level the great the great pageant of the Norwegian migration, which had its own unique qualities. It was an amazing event. This was kind of a primal work on immigration. Again, free land's not available in America anymore, and Rolveig was quite aware that this was kind of a unique thing. This had never happened before. It was probably not going to happen again after it played itself out, which it had pretty much done by the time he died. As a tale of a very human story, I think a beautiful human story, told against the backdrop of a remarkable event of the Norwegian migration to America, and told within the context of someone friendly to immigration, someone friendly to cultural particularities. I think it's almost unequaled still.
Alan C. Carlson provided the introduction and new annotations for the latest print edition of the book Giants in the Earth by Ole Rolveig. The book is published by the South Dakota Historical Society Press. It's available in stores and online now. We'll take a short break. Later in this hour, we will visit the cabin where Ole Rolveig wrote Giants in the Earth. But first, more on the Norwegian-American experience. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are spending the hour understanding the epic Norwegian-American novel, Giants in the Earth. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra is set to perform the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera of the same name. More about that tomorrow. Today, we are turning the pages of Ole Rolveig's book. It's a story published in Norwegian and translated into English. Rolveig was also one of the visionaries behind the founding of the Norwegian American Historical Association in Northfield, Minnesota, at the College of St. Olaf. This year also marks a 200th anniversary, commemorating the journey of 52 Norwegians who set sail for North America. 900,000 of their countrymen would eventually follow. Amy Boxrud is executive director of the Norwegian American Historical Association, also known as NAHA. She made the journey across the border to South Dakota. I asked her about Rolveig's papers at St. Olaf.
It's North America's largest collection of Norwegian American life. It's probably the world's largest collection. And it's America's first ethnic historical association and one of the largest ethnic archives in the country. We have a wide variety of materials from well-known Norwegians. Rolveig, for example, his papers are in our archives. We have more than 70 boxes of materials about Ole Rolveig.
He's very active in corresponding with people as he did the writing.
Yes, and one of the things that we wanted to do when we took on this digitization project for the Rolveig collection was to digitize that correspondence, because he touched so many other people's lives with those letters. I think he had over 1,300 correspondents in that collection. So everyone from, you know, leaders in the community, other writers, aspiring writers, his colleagues, people back in Norway, it really runs the gamut.
So we see some evidence in Giants in the Earth of what he thought about America, what he thought about the Norwegian experience, how that might intersect with the German-American experience, the Native American experience, the Irish-American experience. Do we know from his teachings at St. Olaf, outside the work of fiction, but what his vision for America was?
Well, I think between his own experience as an immigrant and what he observed when he came to South Dakota, those early years in Elk Point with his uncle, he immediately began to understand the trade-offs of immigration and what is lost and what is gained. And I think that was a theme that carried through the rest of his career, really. Through the courses he taught, through the lectures he gave, through the letters he wrote, the work he did with the organizations he supported. Yeah.
Let's talk about the story itself.
Yeah.
It is the story of what? How do you describe the story of Giants in the Earth to people?
You know, one of the great masterpieces of American literature, really. And it has, while it was written about one immigrant group, I think it has so much universal appeal to any person who has immigrated by choice, basically. Understanding the what's gained, what's lost, the cost of immigration. It's been translated into dozens of languages. It's been translated into Braille. You know, it just resonates with so many different groups of people around the world, because while it's a particular story set in South Dakota, I think the story itself is universal human experience.
How did he achieve that? Do you have any sense of why it endures?
You know, I think it was a lot of things coming together. I mean, Rølvaag was a very skilled writer, but he wrote in Norwegian, and he said that was, you know, that was his language. English didn't sing for him, he said in his correspondence. So he needed to find the help of a skilled translator. Lincoln Colcord actually approached him about translating the two novels that had been published in Norwegian to become the one in English, Giants in the Earth. You know, having skilled translation was very helpful. He had people that were translating literally for him, but then he had Colcord as a fellow writer and really a collaborator, and the two of them worked together on the translation. And you can see the manuscript being passed back and forth between them, and then they would come together and hash out the final details. Colcord would read it aloud, and Rølvaag would be looking back on the Norwegian, and then they would stop and they would work out these passages. Sometimes they would have to rewrite. So in some ways, the English edition is different than the Norwegian. And I think that's Colcord's influence. I think another reason that the book is so successful is because it's really based in reality. And that is, you know, he had all the stories of the Berdahl family that he had heard all those years, even though the story takes place before he had come to the U.S. himself. He had Jenny's stories and Jenny's family stories about moving from Fillmore County to Minnehaha County and taking that wagon train across southern Minnesota and settling in this area. And the fact that those are based on real stories, I think the reader can sense that there's a realism to it.
And also he expressed that he was concerned that people would be put off by a scene of childbirth. He said the Puritans are going to get upset. So there's a you know, an earthiness to it, and about who people are when they're surviving.
Yeah.
Which was unique to the time, as I understand it.
I think so. It was a little grittier than other things that were being published at the time.
The cultural importance of it then for people today, what do you think that would be?
The story of migration continues. You know, in some ways, it's never been more important. We're still a nation of immigrants. It's still a theme in everyday life. There's still people leaving one home to make a new life in another home and still making those choices of what they're gaining, what they're losing.
I'm wondering if you can help me understand some of the context of evil, of the malice of trolls, that some things I would call Norwegian folklore, but that also mix in with religious beliefs, especially we see through the eyes of Barrett. You know, the character who is processing what it means to live here, but still thinking about home, but also thinking about the forces of nature personified. Mm-hmm. What does that bring up for you that is important for people to understand?
Well, I think part of it is the setting of the prairie. It was a strange place. It was a powerful place. Anyone who's lived on the prairie and lived through a prairie winter, it's not hard to understand the magnitude of that setting that she was getting used to, you know, leaving the more protected valleys of Norway to these wide open spaces where there was nothing to hide behind. Just you were so exposed both to the elements and to the eyes of God in her mind.
What does she think they've done wrong?
The whole idea of leaving home, leaving her family, back in Norway, and the fact that she left it so maybe willingly and with such optimism. When she gets to the prairie, it starts to weigh on her, and she realizes what she's lost. She starts to feel this both anxiety and guilt.
And Per Hansa feels a sense of ambition,
yeah,
adventure.
Yeah, that optimism.
Optimism.
Yeah, that can-do spirit. You know, it's almost like these two characters were both living in Rolvag's mind, probably at the same time. And on his good days, he probably felt a little bit like Per Hansa. You know, it takes that kind of spirit to leave your home and to go to a new country. But I'm sure there were days or moments when Barrett's character felt more familiar. Those days when you're anxious, you're lonesome, you're homesick. We see some of that in his writing in his travel journal, even leaving Norway. We have Rolvag's travel journal, and he starts talking about what it was like to say goodbye to his mother, what it was like to say goodbye to a woman that he was very taken with in Norway. That pain and that processing shows up really early in his life, in his 20s. Yeah. And I think it's something that never left him. He writes home to Jenny about seeing his family again in Norway after being in North America, and the indescribable feeling of seeing his family again. So obviously that was a very significant departure.
Take us back 200 years when so many Norwegians are coming or emigrating, are leaving Norway, mm-hmm. and they're hearing those stories about where they can go and what's happening in this part of the country. What are they? Are they going away from something? Are they fleeing something? Are they going to something?
Well, it was a combination of push and pull. Pushing out of Norway, where the opportunities were much more limited, land was limited. There was no country other than Ireland that lost a higher percentage of its people to immigration. And those early years of immigration really were very rural. People leaving rural areas and coming to rural areas in North America. As time goes on, then it's more people in urban areas that are also making that move. But early immigration was very rural.
Do you have a sense of what descendants of, you know, Norwegian Americans today, people who have Norwegian ancestry, how they process Norwegian influence in who we are as a country? Like, what did these immigrants bring to us? What are the characteristics of the Norwegian American experience that we might still recognize today?
That's a really good question. There's a deep respect for land, I believe, still. There's a lot of people here that are still, they may have left their farm communities, but they still have ties to rural areas. I think that's something that they brought with them. Certainly a grit. I mean, every immigrant that that stays, you know, has to find a way to make it. Those of us who descended from immigrant families inherited some of that grit. It's also important, though, to remember that a lot of people didn't stay. I've heard up to a third of Norwegian immigrants went back to Norway. And I think that's a really interesting statistic. Some of them never planned to stay, and some of them came and realized it wasn't for them and went back.
Amy Boxrud is executive director of the Norwegian American Historical Association. It's based in Northfield, Minnesota at St. Olaf College, where Rolvag taught. Now, let's follow Ole Rolvag's footsteps a bit further by stepping inside the cabin where he wrote Giants in the Earth. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are spending the hour with Ole Rolvag's epic story of Norwegian immigration, Giants in the Earth. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra performs Giants in the Earth April 26th and 27th in Sioux Falls. It's a Pulitzer Prize-winning opera in three acts written by composer Douglas Moore. Tomorrow on In the Moment, we will follow a winding path from a musical score stored in library archives in New York City to a full house on a Midwestern stage. But today, let's visit the humble house that Ole built. The Rolvag Writing Cabin is now housed on the campus of Augustana University in Sioux Falls. Patrick Hicks is Augustana's writer-in-residence. He opened the doors of the cabin for SDPB on a snowy winter morning.
This writing cabin is probably the most important literary artifact that Augustana University possesses. And when it had to be moved from Heritage Park in order to make way for the hockey arena, because we now have a Division I hockey team, we definitely wanted to situate this cabin someplace. And this grove of trees that we're in right now is adjacent to the Humanities Division, and that seemed like the best place to put it. It did need some structural repair. I mean, this was a hand-built cabin, and I don't think that Rolvag himself expected it to be around 100 years from now. So we needed to support the ceiling, and we put on a brand new roof, which was absolutely necessary. And the expenditures were not significant, but sizable. And then I asked a number of students to help me with smaller forms of renovation. So I asked our Civitas Honors students to help me, for example, paint the floor. So the floor has a brand new coat of paint, but I made a decision to match the paint as exactly as I possibly could. And then we just had to move the furniture back in.
So we think he wrote here in these chairs, on this space right behind me over my shoulder, there's a screened-in sort of area where he would have been looking over the lake. How important was that writing time for him to have, to be surrounded by nature, getting correspondence back and forth about giants in the earth and figuring out how to tell this really complicated story?
Yeah. Where I'm sitting, I can look out one of the windows and there's a desk there. And he would have looked out Big Island Lake. And it was a pretty secluded, you know, forest area. And he would have written on the porch as well. And I think he predominantly did much of his writing on the porch. But to have a sanctuary like this is absolutely vital, especially for a novelist. And I know that he wrote the first draft of Giants in the Earth, September, October, 1923, and he averaged about 5,000 words a day. And you can only really do that if you have the monastic solitude that you need. And I appreciate that he was looking out over this lake with all of these trees, and yet he's writing about prairie grass and the sort of wave-like motion of the prairie grass. And of course, he's writing about winter while he's surrounded by lots of mosquitoes in the summer. There's some dissonance, at least for me. I'm thinking about my own writing process of being situated someplace and being attuned to what is around you. But at the same time, the way the creative writing works is that you get transported somewhere else.
When you're with the students here and they're, you know, being part of this history and matching the paint and restoring the place for visitors to come see. What were some of the conversations that, were they just talking about modern times or were they thinking about who he was and writers of that vintage?
They were, you know, they're college students, so they were worrying about homework and talking about what they were going to be doing for the weekend and talking about the football game and those types of things. But I also did hear snatches of conversation about how they were interested in who Rolvag was and why we have this cabin. And I know that many students here at Augustana go past this cabin and don't quite understand its importance. So at least with my creative writing classes, I always try to bring them in here so that they can see it, they can see the inside of it. It gives me an opportunity to talk about the importance of place for writers and how a place influences a writer. Because Ole Rolvag, when he was born, actually, Ole Edvard Peterson, he chose the last name Rolvag when he immigrated to the States, named after Rolvag Cove, where for generations his family had been raised. And he made his way to this part of South Dakota, and then he enrolled in Augustana Academy, which was a boarding school at the time in Canton. And this, of course, became Augustana today. And I mention all of that because I doubt that he would have written Giants in the Earth had it not been for Augustana and Augustana Academy. So I think it's really wonderful that the institution has worked hard to preserve its past with this cabin.
Yeah. How unusual was it to tell that immigrant story at the time in the way that he did, which is to say in fiction with sweeping landscapes and characterization and the reality of loneliness and isolation and then the joys and celebration? He doesn't tell everything about the experience, we all know, but he tells a lot. Is that common for the time, or was this, that's why the book stood out, I'm guessing?
Yeah, it was an honest rendering of just how hard the immigrant experience was. And certainly he was one of the first, if not the first, Norwegian voices to be writing about what it was like to move to this part of the world and to try to create a life for yourself.
Tell me a little bit about how you think about place as a writer.
Oh, that's such a rich question, Lori. And I guess it depends on what I'm writing about. My novels are often set in, say, Germany and Poland in the 1930s, 1940s. So I have to be very attuned to history. But I've just finished a book on my home state of Minnesota, which was a joy to write. And it was wonderful for me personally to explore where I grew up and to go to places that I'd heard of all my life, but never actually visited. Places like Brainerd and International Falls and the Iron Range. And it was really gratifying to walk around these places and then try to capture in ink what it was like to be there.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about fiction and nonfiction is trying to capture the zeitgeist and to think about how it's influencing character and impacting character. And then if you've done your job properly as a novelist, the reader forgets that they're reading and they're transported somewhere else and they're allowed to dream with you and to go to places that are only in their head. And I think that's the mystery of writing for me. I'm just in awe that that can happen.
The Rolvag Writing Cabin is available for tours. We'll put links on our website with more information. You can also learn more at augie.edu/heritagepark. Now, one of the reasons Giants in the Earth resonates with Americans who have Norwegian heritage is because the essence of their own family histories are played out on the page and now the stage. That is literally true for Charles Burdahl. Jenny Burdahl Rolvag was married to Ole Rolvag. She is Charles Burdahl's second cousin. You've been hearing guests mention Jenny throughout the hour. Rolvag asked Jenny's father for details about their family's journey west to help the author tell a fictional story with detail, accuracy, and authenticity. Charles Burdahl sat down with us in the Rolvag Writing Cabin to share some family memories. Before we begin, if you don't know the ending of Giants in the Earth, a quick warning, we are going to talk about the death of a character here. If you don't want the spoiler right now, step away, come back to this conversation when you're ready. Here's Charles Burdahl.
Well, my grandfather was 10 years old in that wagon train, youngest person there. He was a very quiet man. I regretted the fact that I never asked him any questions about it. Wouldn't have been wonderful to hear firsthand from someone. Andrew and Eric were already gone, and my grandfather was still around. He lived to be 92, living in Gjertsen, a little house in Gjertsen.
Yeah. As we get ready to hear an opera of Giants in the Earth and the new release of a book and new interest, new scholarship, what strikes you as relevant about this story today?
Well, I think it really was a turning point for pioneer novels, because in the past, there was all kinds of romanticism. And of course, in the 20s, that flipped. You had Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Rolvag followed, and then the very thing he brought the psychology of the other person's life into the story. And so I'm hoping that that will come through in the opera, because it's not a sociological piece. It's really a psychological piece about the people that were part of those pioneers.
Say more about that. A psychological piece, how? In what way?
Well, they went into the psyche of the people. Yeah. When you think of a Barrett who was struggling with, you know, seeing the grass flowing as the ocean, and she was moving west, but her heart was back at home, and that's true for a lot of people. How do you continue to move west? And that was what Per Hansa did. He was on the different side, and you saw the contrast between those two people. He was very, very, very open, and you saw the struggle of Per Hansa.
Mm. In Rolvag's later writings, he also struggles with the tension between being an American and being of Norwegian descent,
Absolutely.
Being a Norwegian. Are these two parts of his own psyche in some ways, the relationship between this couple? What do we know about his own wrestling with identity?
He wrestled very much with people losing their tradition and losing who they were. You had to have two lands. In some way, you had to have two lands. And here we are, we're in America. Do we have other parts of the world that we feel a part of as well? Or are we so focused in one place? He helps us to see that it is broader than that.
You mentioned the grasslands as the ocean.
Yeah.
And will any of us ever be able to look at the prairie and not think ocean? He partially does that for us because they came from the ocean.
Yes.
And he flips it to say, this is a sea. This is unforgiving, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah.
That's what I liked about his writing.
Yeah.
He gave sounds and voice to the earth and to creation in a beautiful way. It's and it really helps us to think in terms of our world as more alive, as opposed to something inanimate.
Yeah. You mentioned Barrett, a great female character for the time.
Yes, and she really has, in later books, became the hero. And but her struggles, they were in many ways modeled after Ole's mother-in-law, who was so afraid of the wind, they would want to climb into the box, much like Barrett did.
There's no place to hide.
No place to hide.
Yeah.
The wind gets you all the time.
We can relate to that, can't we?
Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
What kind of stories did you tell at family gatherings, reunions, about the importance of the literature, the book itself?
I don't think we did as much with that as we do now. My kids were given Chance the Earth to read in the inner city of Denver, East High. I have first editions for all of my children.
Wow.
I think it's very important for them to know that story. And as I get older, it becomes more important to remember the roots. You can't forget your roots or where you come from and what that means for you.
It's also a book in translation.
Those first two books, it's two books are written in Norwegian and they were quite popular in Norway. And he had them translated into English in 1927. And there were pastors calling it a sex book. You could get all kinds of conflict until it became such a accepted reading that they suddenly had to take a different look at it. But he was very much maligned in the book, because it was too real.
Yeah, he writes a letter to his wife saying, I'm describing tonight a scene of childbirth. Yeah. Now I just have to convince all these Puritans to read it. So even writing about childbirth was audacious.
Yes, I was interested in the minister. And of course, that's why Per Hansa died, because they wanted him to go get the minister. He had two pair of skis with him. He could have turned around and come back. And you wonder why he decided to sit down looking west. And of course, Ole, he's buried now in Northfield facing west. So it never went away. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. As I was looking at, again, his writings outside the book, outside fiction.
Yes.
His descriptions of Norwegians coming to this part of North America are almost grandiose and fairy tale like. We are going to do great things for human happiness. There are big giants in the earth. There are big heroes and big adventures. And yet there's an awareness in the book of the cost of all of that. And we're aware of who was here before they came.
Yes, I'm so aware of that too.
Yeah, talk about that, please.
Well, I'm so aware of the fact that this land is not our land. That has been blessed by the Native Americans. And it has a spirit and a soul of its own. And I'm so glad how Ole brought into his writing his appreciation of Native Americans. They're humans just like us. He said, I thought, it was terribly important in that time in the 20s. Can you imagine? It was not very acceptable. Mm-hmm. And of course, the stories had always been for the bird owls, how the tribe would come from Pipestone down to Yankton, and they come and they stop in the hill, stay in the hill above the Jenny's farm home. And so that really became a part of the story in some ways too.
What are you hoping from the opera and the crowds that will come and see this story for the first time?
Well, I'm hoping that it will drive them to think about their own stories and to recognize how important it is to remember the stories that you have that need to be told for your family, for your history. And in many ways, that has kept Ole Rovag alive, that book. It never goes away, and I think that's an important part of it. How do you keep alive the things that drive you and keep you a real person in the world?
Did the Norwegian Americans do what Ole thought they were on the cusp of doing? Did they change the character of America? Did they transform this place into something in their image? Did they contribute? What do you think the influence of Norwegian immigration has been on this region and this country?
There are many, many who have brought many gifts to our nation. So you think in terms of the people who have that heritage as a part of them. And my children are I'm blessed by children who have so many gifts, and they continue to give, and that's another generation. When I turn to think in terms of my writing, it has to go to not to my children, but to my grandchildren, and perhaps great-grandchildren, so the story continues to grow and to be remembered as a way to be remembered. Yes, that's one thing, but also a way for them to also dream. Like in this place, it's a place for people to come and dream and smell the magic and the sounds of this place.
What sort of things do you write for your children and grand? Tell me about yourself as a writer.
I wonder to tell my family stories. My father's a very quiet farmer, so I wanted to make sure people knew who he was, and my mother too. And so the first 10 chapters are really about that, about the journey of the family. And now I have a few more chapters where my children come in, so they begin to hear, oh, that's me. And that's what was happening when I was born. So I try to do that.
What's your message for people who feel like they can't write? They're not good writers. They might even be intimidated by the idea of putting some of those stories in words.
I've always told people, you don't have to be a good writer. Just put the word down. Put a word down. It doesn't have to be a sentence. Just an idea. To remember, that's what journaling is about, an idea. Not that you have to have full sentences, wonderful sentences. And I'm not good in English here, Augustana, so I encourage people to always make sure just plain keep the ideas going.
Yeah. Are there any other stories you wanted to make sure to share with people today? Any other things that I didn't ask you that you think are very important to mention?
Jack the Earth again, the honoring of the earth. That's something we can retake from his writing. I loved how he gave the grass sound, a voice. And I think in terms of how we can honor our world by honoring our earth and our environment.
Charles Birdall inside the Rovag Writing Cabin, now housed at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, the story of how an award-winning opera got buried in an archive, and how the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra is giving giants in the earth new life. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.